sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets are running higher. Italy's downgraded below A. And double doom bears are at it again. We got Das on the show today and lots to talk about global economics, current market conditions, and what to do from there. All this and much more on episode number 304 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hi, how are you? Andrew Horowitz here, and so glad you can join me today. It is middle of March 2013 already, and we're coming up on all sorts of records. The markets on the Dow side have been doing great, and there's no stopping, and every seemingly drop of 5 points comes to be met with buyers. And the S&P is on its way possibly to another record as well. And, you know, as we talked about so many times before, that we have to question, where are we in the cycle? Where are we when it comes to markets, individual stocks, whether it's your ETFs, mutual funds, where are we in the cycle right now? Well, I'll tell you that there's a lot of pundits out there that are extraordinarily bullish right now. You know, the comments have gone from, yeah, we're going to see a continuation of this run for some time to, well, we'll see some kind of a consolidation here and then move up. But either way, for the most part, we've been seeing that there's a lot of optimism out there, even in the face of any of the pessimistic, you know, reports that you may see. So in other words, if you find a stock that or an economic report or, you know, some kind of a news story that comes in negative, there seems to be a silver lining on all of it. And if not that, of course, we have the glorious Fed to have that wondrous, wide, and extraordinarily deep safety net that is under everything by them continuing to have quantitative easing and very, very easy monetary policy stances. But let's talk about some of the things that are going on before we get to our guest, Das. And I think that the downgrade of Italy last week was very interesting. And that is really a very sharp and difficult situation now, because now that all the rating services have them under an A rating, the last one was downgraded by Fitch, that's a bit of a concern. Borrowing costs could go up. They could lose access to some funds, and especially on the institutional side, and maybe have to look back to the ECB for some kind of further money bailout, injection, et cetera, to their banks, to their sovereignty. Now, the problem also is dealing with the government there, which is split. So we'll kind of maybe get to some of that discussion with Das, because he knows a lot about that. The other thing I want to talk about is we have, it seems that amidst all the optimism recently, we have also coming out again, Mark Faber and Nouriel Roubini, who are the double doom bears, as I call them, coming out with some negative comments about how we're going to see an imminent or at least a reasonably soon correction for these markets in the neighborhood of upwards of 20%, according to Faber, and somewhere in the 5 to 20% range, according to Roubini. And you have to look at those as, the perma bears or the perma bulls, and take those and push them aside for a second. Fact is that we are seeing some very interesting conditions develop, whether it's the amount of stocks that are over their 20-day, 50-day, 100-day, 200-day moving average, whether it's the fact that the KRI, the key reversal indicator that we have, that we keep track of, is at a 2+, which means that we are getting overheated in the market right now. And whether we look at the low volumes, whether we look at the relatively lackluster earnings that are coming, you know, again, we can discount all this for some time. And it reminds me of many times in the past, and you can pick a year, where there was this optimism that spread because things were going up, not because the data behind it was actually, you know, reflecting and reflective of really what was happening. Yeah, we saw a great jobs number last week, or at least great in the, you know, when you measure it against what the jobs numbers have been recently, 7.7%, unemployment rate on the official side. And at the same time, we saw about, you know, over the 200 mark, 220 or so hirings that were made. Now, there's been some controversy. If you take a look at the web, look at MarketWatch or the Wall Street Journal or, you know, wherever, there's been some controversy about, is this really a good job, good jobs number? Was it more of a part-time kind of a move and that added? Was it a flip-flop between this job and that job that kind of added, but you didn't see the subtraction for some reason? Was it people who have two jobs now because they can't afford one? Either way, doesn't really matter. You have that employers are hiring. That's an important situation. You have that employers are bringing on new people, new blood, and they're willing to take that on rather than not. And that's a good sign from the corporate side of things. Now, you have to also look at the fact that last week we saw a better than expected, or the week earlier, we saw a better than expected manufacturing number, even on the heels of the Philly Fed that was really bad. We saw a better than expected, or right in line, service number that we saw, the ISM non-manufacturing number. And that was good to see as well. So we're getting a lot of decent data points right here. And if nothing else, they're better than analysts and economists expect, similar to what we saw in the earnings season. And that's happening in the U.S. And there's a little bit of a, you know, kind of a better situation that has kind of come in. Next week, we're going to be seeing CPI. That's going to be important. See what's going on with inflation. We're going to see also the new reading, the March reading on the University of Michigan Confidence Index. We'll see if that actually holds up as well as analysts expect in the 78 range, with the fact that this is kind of the first time we're seeing after the sequester, after the payrolls in terms of your payroll tax went down and some of the other things that are going on around the world. So we'll see what that really looks like. And then you have to also look at that the European region is continuing to show recession. And over the weekend, we saw some numbers from China. China has, you know, bounced back very nicely in terms of the all their economic numbers, the stock market. And they saw two things that came out. We saw the import-export number last week, and the import-export number was, I thought, was kind of miserable because you saw this really good export number for some reason, but the import number was horrid. Like they're not buying anything from anywhere. Now, many people would say, well, that's great because what's happening is they're turning into this kind of economy where they're doing a lot more domestic buying. I don't know if that's the actual result, but that's the logic they're trying to put forward. Anyway, we saw that industrial production was also down more than was expected. CPI was up a bit. And in fact, if you look at the total basket of all the things that went on over the last week or so, and then you culminate that with what's gone on since the beginning of the year, and you add that all together, mash it up, and look at it, it's the slowest start that China has had since 2009. That's only 2-3 years, but it goes also back to, you can look back to 2004, and some of these numbers are really back there. So really what we're seeing is the, very clearly, the lack of stimulus causing an economy to go between and ride the line, that line in the sand of contraction and expansion. And that's why economies around the world, I guess, are so hell-bent on putting as much emphasis on providing for the economy rather than pulling out, because we see what happens there. Now, dollar's been rallying pretty well, and it's really a very fascinating study when you see what's happening with the yen. Yen climbed to 96, which is really interesting and really getting to be a point where there's going to be a lot of very angry governments around the world that are going to be looking to them to stop doing this ridiculous amount of, kind of weakening and debasing of their currency. We'll see how long it takes. You know, maybe they'll be able to hit that 100 mark on the yen right now, about 96, about 3% higher from where it is now, or actually lower in terms of valuation. But the fact is that there is a all hands a bailing ship when it comes to the yen right now. And where are they going? They're going to the dollar. They've tried to go to the euro, although the euro keeps on getting smacked pretty good, even after Draghi discussed not really doing much right now. So this whole yen issue is almost the reverse of that repatriation trade we talked about after the Fukushima issue and that massive move of what was going on and how it got really strong for a while and all. It's kind of reversing itself. I don't think that's going to last forever, But the fact is, you got to keep your eye on this because it is causing a lot of global imbalances. Because what will happen is one of our favorite areas of the right now or stocks really to take a look at is Caterpillar. Now think about Caterpillar for a second. Caterpillar is a global manufacturer. Okay, that's good. They do a lot of business in the mining and construction area. Okay, so you got some things going on, particularly in construction in some countries in the U.S., et cetera. But you know what? They also have major competition in Japan. So what you want to look for there is the opportunity possibly that Caterpillar is really going to come up short on earnings because it's much, much better to go after some of the Japanese counterparts and companies that are in competition because their prices obviously just on a dollar-based or another currency-based basis is a lot lower. Now talk about a couple more companies here that I think I want you to look at, that I think you should look at. Las Vegas Sands, LVS. Las Vegas Sands had three specific items that came out over the last couple of weeks. The last one was on Friday when they saw that the gaming revenue on a year-over-year basis slipped about 16% overall for Las Vegas, for the whole state. And there was also the situation where there's an investigation into some of the things that they have said. There's also Macau, where we saw that the revenues were down also there. So I think that while the markets are moving higher, there's a lot of opportunity for people just to be buying anything, regardless of the news, information, fundamentals, et cetera. But if you look at Las Vegas Sands, it's really sitting on a key support level right now, a little bit less than, and it's a very good opportunity to take a look at if you're inclined to short. The other one, which is on the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of how the stock looks, is GNC. Now, this is a store that sells vitamin supplements and all sorts of various muscle building and workout foods, et cetera. Now, there's another company that is very similar. It's called The Vitamin Shoppe. Now, their stock has been just all over the place and it's been hit pretty hard recently. I want you to look at GNC because if you look at the actual chart, and one of the things we look at is this relationship between volume at any given price and the price where it is now. And if you look at that and you see that giant daily chart where it kind of shoots up on the right, gaps up a bit, there's really nothing underneath there. And it looks like GNC is a little bit vulnerable to a, 5-7% downside. Now, again, it will maintain itself for some time, probably if markets continue to be very, very strong and everybody's buying every single dip. But once that happens and the buyers pull out a bit, you know, you're really going to have a gap down to the floor of the next level. And I think you should really take a look at that. Study those charts because those are very interesting. Not every chart right now is working because you have this constant flow. And what's happened is that breakdowns are turning into support levels right where they shouldn't be. And breakouts are turning into the high where they kind of are putting a stop to it, if you will. We're kind of holding it. And again, not every stock, but there is that very interesting dynamic that's happening right now where there's all this enthusiasm and bullish sentiment that is going on in the market. So that's something that you don't always see. You want to find those stocks that were supposed to, quote unquote, break down. They didn't because you're in a bullish scenario. Keep those on a watch list for shorts and find those stocks that really have not been able to, go lower than, let's say, the resistance point. They're kind of like hanging around there. And, those are going to be pretty good probably in the bullish markets because they'll just break out and move higher. So there's kind of a opposite spectrum for both the short and the long side right now. In terms of the market itself, in terms of the bonds, you know, we're seeing a rotation a bit, very slowly, very, very slowly out of bonds. There is some concern that the Fed may actually do something like maybe stop their, QE, on time. Everybody thinks it's going to run forever, it seems, these days. And they're going to also possibly consider, not doing any extraneous and extraordinary measures beyond what they've done already in terms of, monetary policy. We still have a lot to look for when it comes to the sequester. This really hasn't hit yet. None of the finances have hit. The White House is actually closing their doors to visitors and to tours starting this week, I believe it is. And, we're going to start seeing those layoffs. We're going to start seeing the financial repercussions of the sequester starting very shortly. It has not started yet. So when we're looking at conditions in the markets and sentiment and jobs and, money being spent, et cetera, and it's also almost bewildering how the defense companies have been not only withstanding this, but they have been in great shape. So when this actually does start coming in, the reality is that, hey, these cuts have happened, because I think there is a overtone that the government will come in and do something because there's all this potential problems. But remember something. The only time we've ever seen them come in at the last minute is when there's a lot of panic and there's a lot of things happening that could be very negative. Already we have better jobs. We have the markets close to, you know, highs on most of the markets. And you have all these things that are good. Sentiment is up. Why do they have to come in? There's no impetus for them to do anything at this point. And when they're not at a point where their backs are against a wall, their feet to the fire, if you will, they don't do anything. So I would not be so optimistic about the shining knight coming in to rescue the markets at this point, or at least the situation when it comes to the sequester, because it's just, you know, they don't have any reason to, if you think about it. Let's get to our guest, Das, because he always has so much interesting commentary, and he wrote a couple of pieces that I actually have just read. One of them was called Perception of Beauty and Stock Valuations, and the other one, let me get the name actually, of it, was Money in the Time of Financial Cholera. Very colorful guy, great writer, and you make sure to keep tabs on him, because he has a good nose for where things are and the reality of the situation versus kind of what is being said oftentimes out there that may really create a bit of a shroud of uncertainty. I think he's a good guy to clear some of this up, and I have a lot of questions. Hey, guess what, folks? Yeah, you're right. We have who you've always asked for. You've always said, hey, where is he? The one, the only, Das is with us today, all the way from down under. We're having a nice discussion with him regarding, well, all sorts of things that you need to know about, of course, and some of the things that we have talked about before are starting to brew up again, Das, aren't they?
Oh, it's a very interesting time, but I think happy days are here. The Dow's reached new heights. Everybody's happy. The 50,000 people who are basically on the streets of New York, they're the only ones who don't get it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that we have this Dow at all-time highs on a nominal basis, not on an inflation-adjusted basis, because on an inflation-adjusted basis, we have a little more to go. But okay, you know, we have that round number. And for some reason, we all of us have a fascination with a couple things. Number one, we have a fascination with countdowns, right? Something, you know, counting down. We have a fascination with a target, you know, getting somewhere, you know, getting to a certain number and achieving that. We have a fascination with this whole all-time highs and all that. I think it's a human issue that pushes some of this, and some of it's kind of inevitable. But when you look at the Dow, or, you know, markets in general, it is fascinating how there is this incredible change of character and sentiment, maybe, that started this year that I find to be almost bizarre, frankly, because you have this, you know, all of a sudden this great sentiment that, and it's like, you know, January 1st started and it hasn't stopped. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think you're right about the psychology. I mean, I've been looking at this rally for a while. I think I remember talking to you about the fact that we're going to get massive melt-ups and massive meltdowns in this period of history. And I think it's almost psychological in the sense that people have been worrying for 5 years, and they're basically having a last great shindig almost. Basically, they decide, oh, well, what the heck? Let's go and have a party. And as you say, the target was very, very close. So they basically did it. But there's some very interesting sort of dissonances and differences. The first thing is, if you look at the market, it's being underwritten by some very interesting things which we all know about, which is the money printing, but also the fact that it provides some dividend yield when securities like government bonds don't provide any. And obviously there is this incredible belief in the Bernanke put that somehow he wants to keep the stock market up. But what I find really interesting is that people aren't talking about is all the stock buybacks. Mm-hmm. And all the sort of stuff that's going on, which is like mergers and acquisitions because of the cash sitting on corporate balance sheets, which is all underpinned that. But ultimately, you know, it's got to tie up somewhere with the real economy. And, you know, I just sort of, when the Dow broke the record, I sat down and looked at October 2007 and compared a couple of numbers. GDP growth then was, say, 2.5-3. It's probably sub 2 now. Unemployment is probably about double. If you take the U6 measure, it's probably more than double. Number of Americans on food stamps has gone from about 27 million to 48. Gas prices were under 3, they're now close to 4. U.S. debt has gone from 78% of GDP, and it's double that now. Deficit, and this is the most interesting number. The deficit has gone from about $100 billion to about $1 trillion. Debt has gone from $9 trillion to $16. The other interesting thing in looking at those numbers is if the Dow is not going up based on roughly about $1 trillion deficit and $1 trillion of money printing by the Fed, and that's, let's put it into perspective, that's $5,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. When is it going to go up? And it goes back to the fundamental point that you made. It's just got back to the levels of 2008, right? 2008, 2009, somewhere around that. So you've had really 4 or 5 fallow years. So as you say, you have to adjust for inflation. But if you're a foreign investor, it's even more interesting because the U.S. dollar has come down by 15%. So realistically, you're about 25% down, which is actually what European markets and other markets around the world are. So it's kind of, you take it into perspective in that way. But hey, while the party's going, everybody's going to be up and dancing. I think Chuck Prince is coming back into fashion, you know. Everybody's got to dance while the music's playing. Mm-hmm. So the point is that I think, you know, Andrew, I know you know when to sit down. Just before the music stops, you always know when to sit down. I hope everybody else does.
Well, the question is when to stand up sometimes. That's the bigger problem. You know, the problem is...
Well, I've got 2 left feet, so I never stand up.
You know, I have a question for you because I just happened to be snoodling around the web and... You have a whole website page at Amazon that is dedicated to you. And, you know, I know people, if they don't know, first of all, that he has a book out called Extreme Money. I think that's your latest book, right? Yeah.
Latest and last.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I'm looking down this list and you go back to credit derivatives, swaps and derivatives, structured products. I mean, these are just... Now, here's a book that I'm kind of wondering about. Is this you in search... the Pagolin Eco Travel?
Yes,
so,
that's my real passion in life, is basically wildlife.
Really?
I don't really care about human beings very much.
Yeah, well. So you've been all, I mean, I'm assuming Galapagos and various parts,
yeah.
Of course, down under where you live now, and there's a whole other page
last
of books
year
here.
We were in Brazil for
really?
About
nice.
5 weeks, and so yeah, that's what we do in a living. So I am a very confused individual. Most people have accused me of being many things, but I just say I'm confused.
Yeah, well, that's great stuff. So let's talk a little bit about the yen, because this has been a topic that I have been focusing on for some time now. In fact, we've been in and out of the we'll call it the long yen. In other words, looking for the yen to increase versus where it's been doing recently is decrease. And I'm fascinated about a couple things. Number one, that first of all, the denial, which, you know, the Japanese have been very good at that. We know that. The denial that they are not doing anything to actually push down the yen. In fact, what they're doing is quite the opposite. They're just creating monetary policy and the yen is reacting. Interesting. I've done some studies on this, and I think I've sent these to you before. We posted one actually this week about the actual trade-weighted, if you will, value of the yen. And you can make an argument that the 10-year average is about round number 100. So getting there right about where we are now, 95 or so, is not, you know, out of the question. But I wonder from you the extreme nature of how fast this has plunged in terms of a major currency and devalue.
Well,
what is the story? I mean, where does this go?
Well, I think fundamentally, there's about 3 or 4 stories here. One is about Japan. One is about the so-called currency wars. And one is about why the market reacted from a technical level. Let's get the technical level out.
Can I interrupt you? I'm sorry.
Yep,
I have
of course.
You can't say currency war. Christine Lagarde was absolute about this in her discussion at the G20 meeting, where they, you know, the impotent folk over there didn't do anything and didn't censure Japan. But she said there are no currency wars. She hasn't heard of any. There are currency worries, but not currency wars. So let's just kind of get that set.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. Mm-hmm. It was just semantics. We'll call it a currency skirmish.
Skirmish. Good. Skirmish.
A skirmish. Yeah. It's a skirmish. But coming back, on a technical level, I think a lot of money flowed into yen as a safe haven because everything that could happen had happened in Japan, so people figured you can discount the downside. So a lot of money was sitting there. And what Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who's come in, has done is basically rehash all the old policies, as you correctly say, of essentially expanding the Bank of Japan's balance sheet, printing money, and essentially spending more in terms of government expenditure. They have more bridges to nowhere, more roads to nowhere, more everything to nowhere. But, you know, you can always do with another road to nowhere, mm-hmm. another bridge to nowhere. Mm-hmm. So they're going to build that. So all of that's coming in. But there's a fundamental interesting issue about that. The interesting thing is Japan is clearly trying to devalue, because the only part of the economy that has been doing really well has been the export industry, because the rest of Japan is a basket case. So they want that to improve. But the problem is, over the last probably 10 years or so, the appreciation in the yen has killed them. And you just have to look at the balance sheets of companies like Sharp, Sony, and so forth, who are all extremely vulnerable now. So what they're trying to do is use the export line. But the problem here is not everybody can have the cheapest currency, because everybody's doing it. And the most interesting thing was, you're correct about Christine Lagarde at the G20, the biggest supporter of the Japanese position was, guess who? The United States.
Right.
The United States undersecretary. So no, Japan is just pursuing fiscal and monetary policy to revitalize its economy. I'm saying, yeah, that's because you're doing exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. And if you accuse China of manipulating the currency, that's okay. But if you accuse Japan of manipulating its currency, it's a bit more tricky, because you're following the same policy. But I think fundamentally, the Japanese position is going to become much, much more tricky, because the currency is the only thing that Abe has actually done which has worked. And there's a lot of, I suppose, hope built in about what the Bank of Japan is going to do. Now, the Bank of Japan I've dealt with for 25, 30 years, and they're a funny bunch of people. They're bureaucrats. They hate the government. In fact, their biggest enemy, somebody once told me, was the government, the elected government. They said it was their biggest enemy. And he said, you know, we like everybody else, but the government's impossible to deal with. And they're going to put every barrier in place. And what Abe is doing is replacing the governor.
Mm-hmm.
As I've said, replacing the governor is useless. You have to replace almost every individual there, because something happens when you walk through the portals of the Bank of Japan. They go kind of feral. And they're putting up these lovely little barriers, like Abe has said, we will have 2% inflation. They've basically said, of course, we embrace 2% inflation, but the government has to cause it. We can't do it. So everybody's saying, well, exactly how does that work? Now they've got a new rule. They put a self sort of rule in there. It's one of the funniest rules I know in modern central banking. They can't hold government bonds more than the banknotes that they have on issue, particularly long-dated government bonds. And they've run up against that limit. So now they're saying, well, unless we change that rule, which is actually self-imposed, we can't actually help you by printing more money. And everybody sort of sits there and goes, what? What's that mean? Besides which, about 2 years ago, they actually changed the rules sort of slightly and said something they were doing was not within the rules. So it's all sort of nonsense. So everybody's assuming they're going to buy long-dated Japanese government bonds, mm-hmm. do what the U.S. is doing. I'm not actually convinced that you're going to see that much action. The other problem Abe has is he's got this massive budget deficit, but at the same time, as we all know, Japan has a massive government debt. And that's been very, very easy to fund because of Japan's own domestic savings. But as the population ages, all the forecasts are telling us that around about 2015, 2016, Japan will not necessarily be able to fund its budget deficit mm-hmm. and its government debt domestically.
Right.
Which means they either print money or they try to fund overseas. But what they have is massive holdings of U.S. treasuries and so forth. So the first port of call probably will be selling those, which is not going to be good. But the problem with selling that is they're going to have to then sell dollars, buy yen. So I'm not quite sure how they can keep the yen down under those circumstances.
Yeah, there's very interesting.
There's a lot of complications.
There's a lot of complications because really in the last, I'll say in 2013, the movement of currencies, and we're just going to take three as an example because they've really been the highlight. The U.S. dollar strengthening above 82. You see the euro just, you know, all over the place with every comment from Draghi. And the yen. What's interesting to note there is that, you know, there seems to be a sell yen by euro, you know, a sell yen by dollar, of course, right? But at the same time, you got to wonder how long the U.S. is going to put up with the dollar rising. Okay, they're happy now because everything, you know, you still have oil going up and commodities are kind of like hanging in there. And you have, but there's two questions, you know, if in fact they start to drop that again, because obviously the competition is mounting when you have a significant exporter like Japan and you have a significant supposed exporter like the U.S. We're supposed, you know, we don't, but we would like to be. And now you're going to be doing battle because a company like Caterpillar, which, by the way, is my favorite short right now. Why? Well, simply, if there is a company that's looking for equipment that Caterpillar sells, well, now they have another option. They say, well, wait a minute, Caterpillar, you are this price. And Komatsu or whoever else may be in Japan may say, well, or, you know, around that region that in Japan that has a similar equipment, they may say, well, wait a minute, I can get this pretty much at a currency discount at this point. I can get it at a 15% discount, so why not buy it from them?
Absolutely. And this is one of the interesting things about the U.S. stock market rally, because one of the really bright spots has been exports, simply because of the cheaper dollar. And as you correctly point out, the currency skirmishes may reverse that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the biggest issues. The other thing is, if you look at the translated earnings, because most American companies like the McDonald's, like the IBMs of the world, essentially make a lot of their money overseas. The weak dollar has helped boosting their translated earnings. Mm-hmm. That'll start to reverse, and that'll show up in the earnings per share numbers. It has no cash effect, but it will show up in the earnings per share numbers. So all of that is there. But the other interesting thing will be, and this is where I think the real risk lies, the currency skirmishes of the first sort of cycle. If that doesn't work, what do? Mm-hmm. You move down the list mm-hmm. of trade restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
So you start to do other things,
right,
like prevent people from selling things or put, you know, bilateral trade arrangements in place, all of those things.
Yeah, tariffs.
And that's much
yeah.
more dangerous.
Right.
And tariffs, ultimately. But tariffs are more risky because of the World Trade Organization and all that sort of stuff. But it is going to go down the path of everybody sort of circling the wagons and closing off. Because the real fundamental issue in a low-growth world is everybody wants to get as much of the growth as possible. And currencies, together with every other policy tool, is just one way you achieve that. And that's what it is. But the funniest comment on the currencies wars, let's call it what it is, was from New Zealand. You know, New Zealand is a tiny economy, and their currency has gone up enormously, like the Australian dollar and the Canadian dollar and so forth. And they're finding it very difficult to compete. And there's been pressure on the New Zealand Central Bank, which is the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, to intervene. But their finance minister is a guy called Bill English, who's actually a very, very straightforward and very straight-speaking guy. He was asked whether they're going to intervene. He said, well, firstly, you basically have to have a couple of hundred billion in the bank. We don't. And secondly, if we now go into this war, basically it's like us going into a battle zone with a pea shooter.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. And that was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, and he's absolutely right. And the real loss here, which is actually kind of tragic, is the smaller economies, the opener economies of the world, and to some extent the emerging markets. Because everybody's looking at the emerging markets to sell their products for growth and everything else. But the higher currencies there are starting to have very, very adverse toxic side effects like asset inflation, like domestic inflation through commodities, and them having to choke off growth. So ultimately, this is sort of not beggar thy neighbor, it's beggar thyself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's actually happening.
Yeah. Now, is there any potential? Well, let's go back here. I mean, a lot of this started because there was a hole to fill. Central banks were the last resort, the last place to get money from, and the banking and the residential sector and the economies around the world, and they stepped in. And they stepped in with 1 foot, 2 foot, and now their whole entire body. And they can't get out. And in fact, I looked at a really interesting chart just, I think, yesterday by Tom McClellan. And he does a great job of plotting the quantitative easing and how much the Fed is buying in bonds and kind of charts that. And then puts it against, let's say, the S&P 500 and shows a really interesting correlation to, and almost on a daily correlation, to how much the Fed is buying versus where the markets go. And when the liquidity dried up and there was no more buying after QE1, let's say, we had a big drop-off. After number two, big drop-off. You know, number three, big drop-off during that segmented time that there was kind of the not knowing what was going to happen with, you know, unlimited QE. And at this point, the central banks, and particularly the Fed, are they ever really going to be able to get out? Because they've been more vocal and involved and intervening as ever I've seen it, even when markets around the world and economies around the world have at least, I don't want to say healed, but they've kind of come back to a level that they're not just, you know, done and cooked.
Well, I think there's two issues. The first is, can monetary policy, because fiscal policy and monetary policy are now basically sort of switched around, but essentially can monetary policy restore the health of the economy? And my view is, without addressing the fundamental structural issues like too much debt, like basically global imbalances, and in certain countries, you know, labor markets and so forth, like in Europe, you can't do that. But you can basically lay down firm and essentially avoid damage. Mm-hmm. And that's what the central banks have done. That's the first thing. But they're now, and one of the most hilarious things about that is the central banks don't seem to actually recognize their limits, because you'll remember Chairman Bernanke now has linked monetary policy to things like unemployment. Which is kind of interesting.
It's
because
ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. Yeah, which is no causal link. How the hell can you link one thing to the other? It's like saying, if that happens, this happens.
Right.
I thought you should have linked it to the phases of the moon or Halley's Comet reappearing.
Yeah, that would be better. Like Halley's Comet would probably be the same, better judgment of that, because
even though it's 86 years away, it's probably about the right time, right?
And it's almost the same thing as what Japan is doing with this arbitrary 2% number that they picked up, you know,
exactly.
If they want to push it to, which, you know, that could happen. By the way, just to step back for a second, I've had too many conversations about the same thing that's really troubling, and it's very hard to answer this question because there is two right answers. And the question is about inflation. Supposedly there's no inflation or limited or subdued inflation in the United States. Okay. And we know that because we see the official numbers, and you can carve out energy and food and all that, and you get, you know, whatever it is, a sub 1%-ish, 2% inflation, which is not really considered an inflationary environment. Okay, right? You with me?
Yep.
Meanwhile, everything costs more.
Yep.
And I'm not trying to overdo it by saying everything, but I mean everything costs more. How does that work?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. The first thing is the measures are so arbitrary. The baskets that are put in place are so arbitrary, like things like imputed rent on your property and so forth, which is nonsense. And I'll give you a very good example of that. In Australia, we have exactly the same phenomena. One of the reasons is the strong Australian dollar, which means things that people don't buy very often, like cars, computers, and so forth, have plunged in price. But everything else, like energy costs, day-to-day food costs, have gone up. So it depends on what you consume and what you don't consume. The baskets are misleading, and they've been deliberately misleading. As you know, there's this body called the Shadow Government Statistics, which actually has constructed a completely different series to the one that the Bureau of Statistics does. And under those circumstances, they found inflation is being understated. But leave that to one side. I think fundamentally, there's a different issue about inflation. But just before I get to that, there's a very funny story about that. In Argentina, when they were having hyperinflation, their statistician, their government statistician, decided that anything which rose more than a certain amount was automatically taken out of the index because nobody could afford it. And so I think, you know, we haven't quite got to that point, but we're not getting terribly far from it. But coming back to this whole issue, I think the central banks always knew that the only two ways that you get out of that is strong growth, which we're not going to get because it was debt-fueled and debt's not there. Second issue is inflation. You can get out of it with inflation. Basically, you rob all the lenders, you know, reward all the borrowers. The problem with that is I think there is almost a mythical belief that printing money is going to cause inflation. But I think it does, but it needs a lot of other conditions. The first is it needs the banking system to work to create the multiplier effect, and the banking system isn't working. They're not lending. The second issue that doesn't work at the moment is you need to have a demand-supply imbalances. In other words, demand is very strong demand and supply constraints, which forces up prices. The problem here is that if you look around the world, there are what we call output gaps. In other words, what theoretical GDP growth should be and what we have. So there's surplus capacity. And if you look around most of the industries around the world, there's surplus capacity. And the other thing is, if you actually look at that, creating inflationary expectations is pretty difficult. Because I think over the last 20 years or so, since the Volcker days, people have gotten accustomed to low rates of inflation. So inflation is not a topic of conversation in a major sense. So it's very difficult to suddenly get people very scared about inflation. Because let's boil it down to why you want inflation. You want inflation because it reduces the actual real value of debt. And the second reason you want inflation is to devalue your currency, which is what most people are trying to do through quantitative easing. But there's another element. It's to accelerate consumption because people assume it's going to cost more tomorrow, so they buy today. That's what they're trying to do. But that's not happening. So I think there are a group of people out there who are running around with sandwich boards screaming hyperinflation. It may happen, but it's not going to happen soon. And that's the problem for the central banks, is that the two basic tools they have, leaving aside the statistical aberrations about inflation, growth and inflation itself, isn't working. which goes back to your fundamental point. Having done all of this as a central bank, what do you basically do next? And particularly, how do you withdraw? As you'll know, Andrew, from your childhood days, there's a contraception technique called withdrawal, and it has to be practiced extremely carefully.
Yeah.
I just hope that the central banks are actually very adroit, and if they're not, we're going to have a problem.
Yeah.
And you know, the central bank, one of the key things is, and I think this is where the dissent on the Fed board's coming from, the Federal Reserve Board of Governors coming from, is I think a group of them have realized that if the policy works, they're doomed, simply because what will happen is the long end of the curve will go up, and since they own so many long-end bonds, they're going to take a massive loss. And if it doesn't work, they're doomed anyway, because they're going to be stuck with these bonds and never be able to sell them, and they'll become like 90% of the economy, which doesn't really work. So I think that's where the dissent is coming from. And I think the most other interesting thing is in Europe, Mario Draghi has become very, very cautious about upping intervention.
Mm-hmm.
You notice how his language has changed from "we can do whatever" to, you know, "it's a political problem, you know, monetary policy can only do certain things, we can't fix the structural problems." That shift in language to me is very interesting, because I think he's not a fool. He's watched what other people are doing, and he's going, "I don't want to head down this path unless I know it actually is going to work, and I'm not sure it's going to work."
You know, there's a couple of things just to talk about. You mentioned that the banks aren't lending. I mean, you know, it's come back a bit. It's doing a little bit better, but I agree with you. They're being very cautious, and maybe in a way we should be very thankful that they are being more, you know, they're using more better judgment in who to lend to, and they're not just freely flowing money out there. But, you know, and then we see like the housing market at least stabilizing from a very low base, and housing sales are still, if you look at a long-term chart, are pathetic. But the builders are doing really great. Banks seem to be doing great, at least from their stock prices of late. You know, they're hopefully going to get their dividend paying capacity back, for most of them been upping that. But one of the things that is really still in the mix, and it actually was flared up again after a comedian and a convicted felon was two of the parties on the ticket for the Italian election. And one of them actually came in strong, we'll call it a strong second, that actually would enable him to control part of the government and therefore creating some kind of gridlock, et cetera. So you got to love Berlusconi. You got to love the guy. I mean,
how do you
not love that guy?
Look, Italy is one of the great, great theatrical events of the world. I mean, if you have an election where a philanderer, an economist, an ex-communist, and a comedian runs for power and the economist comes last, it tells you something about the country.
Exactly.
And I think it's probably the correct judgment. The comedian came first.
Right.
I mean, we need a good laugh here.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important thing is, I don't think people should underestimate the influence of Beppe Grillo, which is the Five Star Movement, the comedian. He's a very astute guy, but he is, he's actually closest to what used to be known as the situationists or the anarchists, in terms of political movement in the 1950s and 1960s. He's out to basically destroy the two mainstream parties. He refers to, obviously, Silvio Berlusconi as psycho dwarf, and he also refers to Mario Monti as rigor mortis, because that's what happened to basically the Italian economy. And he is not going to roll over necessarily and form a coalition. And the danger here is that I think Bersani wants to be prime minister. God knows why anybody would want to be prime minister of Italy in this circumstance, but he wants to be prime minister. He's going to have a minority government. And basically what that's going to mean is that we're going to get a prolonged period of uncertainty, which is not uncommon in Italy, simply because we've had 60 governments since the war. But the problem is they're entering a very difficult phase. And let's back up a stage from that. Why is it difficult? Now, as you know, the rally in Europe was based primarily on the fact that Mario Draghi announced the outright monetary transactions. He would do whatever it takes, which everybody knew meant buying Spanish and Italian bonds. The problem is, for him to activate the program, the government has to ask, the government of the country has to ask, and they have to agree to certain stringent conditions. Now, this was very different from the previous interventions by the ECB, where they could do it without any of these conditions. The problem now is in Italy, this gridlock and this problem with nobody getting a majority is that which government of their own volition is going to commit political and electoral suicide by A, asking for aid, and B, agreeing to conditions. And that's what Beppe Grillo has set up brilliantly. And that actually explains why Draghi is pulling back. So I think Italy is going to be a real mess for a prolonged period of time. I just can't believe how sanguine financial markets have been. I mean, the yields have backed up a bit, but given the circumstances in Italy and how bad it could get very quickly, I'm just absolutely astonished. All I can say is that obviously financial market traders have, you know, very, very big round things down in the nether regions.
Mm. Well, I mean, I think besides having big cojones, we'll say, the fact is that, you know, they're banking on, as we've seen, I don't want to call it worked, but we've seen as the backdrop of all this, that governments will step in when it is, you know, needed, and they'll turn on and off the spigot. But the other thing about Italy, which I think is really important to address, is that they are the third largest holder of debt, government sovereign debt, in the world behind United States, Japan, Japan first, United States, and then Italy. And we're talking about an economy that is a dwarf as compared to the other two. And
that's right.
With the amount of debt that they have and the debt load that they have, you know, any kind of disruption in the financial markets, particularly when it comes to the fixed income and sovereign debt, is a big issue. And the other thing that I think that is really important to stress at this point right now, yes, we are in a celebration that the Dow, as we said, is, you know, at a high and markets are okay and yields are low in terms of bonds and you get, I mean, everything, you know, there's nothing that's not doing well, no matter how bad it is in a way, is the fact that, and I've said this before, when you have a financial emergency like we saw back in 2007, 2008, or whatever year you want to call it, and who do you have to step in? Well, when the banks go down and when you have, you know, individuals in debt crisis, et cetera, well, the government then comes in, the sovereigns come in, and they can do things like lower interest rates and possibly do some fancy accounting and, you know, allow for banks to no longer hold things at market, mark to market, but change the valuation so it looks better on the books and all sorts of fun things that can happen. Okay, great. Well, here's the thing. What happens when the sovereigns need a bailout? Who's next? It's God. That's it. There's nobody left.
I think basically you're absolutely correct, because one way to think about the last 20 years is companies borrowed too much, then they passed the debt to the individuals who borrowed too much, now they've passed the debt to the governments who borrowed too much. Now I'm just waiting to see who the governments are going to pass the ball to.
Yeah, I find that amazing. Now just let's wrap up. Let's talk about something that I have not talked about and I need some more information on, because you and I talked about it, but it's not something I really have a lot of knowledge of. It's in Italy and Europe, this Cyprus situation. Can you give me a little backdrop of it and tell me what's going on there?
Well, actually, Cyprus is a tiny country, and essentially, normally, you wouldn't actually spend a lot of time worrying about it. But essentially, their banking system is completely bankrupt, and it needs a massive bailout. Now, that in itself is pocket change for the European Union, and there would be no problems. But the Germans, in particularly, are very reluctant to lend money to Cyprus, because I think they figured out Cyprus is a tiny economy and they would be lending an amount which is some multiple of the economy, and they don't think they can be paid back. And they're really concerned, because having promised the German people that they would never lose money, it would not be within the character, particularly leading up to Angela Merkel's campaign for re-election. It wouldn't be a good time. So they've come up with this really cockamamie scheme to actually effectively write down the debt of these banks. And the debt consists of two parts. One is bank-issued bonds, and the other is the depositors. And the European Union, who have an infinite capacity to rationalize anything, have rationalized this, what they call the bail-in, rather than the bail-out, by saying, look, all the depositors and bondholders are really Russian oligarchs who actually move money out of Russia, so who cares? But the problem is, we've already seen about 1.7 billion euros, which is roughly about just under 20% of the deposits in these banks, leave. And the real issue is, okay, well, we do this for Cyprus, it lowers the amount the European Union have to put in, and we will move on. But having set the precedent, and we've seen this in Europe in the last two or three years, once they set a precedent, they can use that over and over again. So basically, everybody now looks at themselves and said, well, okay, they wiped out the depositors and bondholders in the Cyprus bank, in the Cypriot banks. Well, if I'm depositing money with a Greek bank, an Italian bank, a Spanish bank, or a Portuguese bank, or an Irish bank, shouldn't I take it out and put it somewhere else? And that will set off the mother of all runs, potentially.
And this is, by the way, this is the same thing that happened, although it hasn't really had reverberations at this point yet, when they had the derivative and the credit default swaps that did not pay off, for the most part, on companies because they did not, the official organization that was going to have to be the one that would say, okay, you know, this is a default, that is a qualifying event, and therefore the CDS can pay off. That really never happened. I mean, there was some, yeah, there was some cases here and there, and Greece, even though they defaulted, there was only partial payment made on that deal, right?
Exactly. But the big thing was the only people who were actually losing money, there were a few external investors and so forth. A lot of them were banks and official agencies which were holding the bonds. So they were able to get around that to a large extent with some very fancy accounting, as you were pointing out. And under those circumstances, they could minimize the risk. But now they can't. Because I think what this will be is the worst form of contagion effect that you're actually going to see. And this is a risk. I think the European Union certainly is starting to become aware of it. And I think this is going to be a huge issue. So keep the Cypriot mess in your radar screen. Because while it's completely irrelevant in size, as a precedent, it could be very, very dangerous. Hmm. And it would set off repercussions which are very, very difficult to manage. And as we all know, you know, it's the little events that actually trigger some of these things. And as those of you with a historical bent will remember, is the murder of an archduke in the Balkans set off the First World War. And if anybody had looked at what would set off the First World War, that wouldn't have been high on anybody's list.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, listen, I appreciate your time. And, of course, you know, fascinating conversation, as always, to talk about things that are present, but also some things that are kind of under the surface that we need to be aware of, and some of the ramifications of how things actually are. And, you know, I think that maybe you won't agree with this, but, you know, when we say that, you know, this time is different and all that, that's never really the case, is it? I mean, you know, when there's bad things that happen and when there's poorly planned, poorly conceived, poorly executed plans like that's happening in Cyprus or that's happening, you know, for example, by flooding the markets and by devaluing your currency, et cetera, I mean, good things can't come from that.
No, but Andrew, you have to have a bit of common sense in all of this. And the first thing is, what caused the problem? Have we fixed any of the problems?
No.
The answer is no. Mm-hmm. The second issue is, who was in charge when the problems occurred? Did they actually anticipate any of this, or did they actually cause the crisis? Are they still in charge? And what makes us think that they have any better idea this time around?
Yeah,
and
by the way,
that's what absolutely puzzles me.
Bernanke did not see any of the, he missed the whole bank, the housing crisis, which is fascinating, okay? That, I think, in itself really is like, wow. Now, whether or not he didn't know about it, whether or not he didn't want to deal with it, whether or not, you know, I don't think any central bank is really like putting the clamp down, except in China, it seems. They don't like putting the clamp down to try to do what they can to, you know, hold down a situation, hold down inflation and all that, unless it's out of control. Then,
I agree.
You know, I think the best thing that can happen is higher interest rates. We'll see what happens with that. And, you know, at the same time, I also think that because of the fact that there was no repercussions due to the fact that the sequestration went into effect and all that, it's not going to move our political environment to do anything. There's been no repercussions from any of their bad decisions. Therefore, they don't have to do anything good.
I think that's right. There's no accountability. And one of the most interesting things about central banks is they're not elected. They're not really accountable. I mean, how do you get rid of a Fed chairman? Think about it logically. You know, they're a fixed-term appointment.
Right.
It's just very difficult to do. And I think the political process now is actually the real issue. Because I have been saying, and you and I have talked about this, for the last 18 months or so, the problem moved from being an economic, financial one to a political, social one, because it comes down to a simple thing. People have lent money to people who are not going to pay them back, so somebody's going to have to take the cost. And of course, in the good old way that we all think, none of us personally want to take the cost, so we're all sort of playing this wonderful game of the loaves and fishes, trying to make, you know, feed this mass multitude and pretending there's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you can keep that going. And I think one of the things I think that is important to remember is these guys, particularly central banks, have very deep pockets. And they can keep this going for a considerable period of time, and they already have. People forget that they've kept this whole system from imploding for 4 or 5 years. That's a long time in the greater scheme of things. The point is that you've got to remember to find a seat to sit down just before they run out of ammunition. Mm. And the problem is that is going to be really, really hard to tell. And it's going to be something small which triggers that moment. And I tell you what, I'm looking for another planet at that point, particular point in time, because I don't want to be here.
Yeah.
You know, I've signed up for Richard Branson's galaxy. I just ran
an
email.
Nice.
I just said I want to go, but they said, you know, what flight? I said one-way ticket, please. I don't want to come back. They were a bit bemused by that.
Yeah, I hear you. Got to love Branson, too. Great guy. Hey, Sanjay Das, you got to get his books. There's lots of them, whether you like something about finance or, you know, economy or ecology, I guess is the point, right? Anything with anything with eco in it, he's the man. You can go get it over at Amazon. We'll put some links on the website of this particular podcast. You can go to the show notes and find it over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks, buddy. See you soon.
Thanks very much. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Another great conversation with Das. And if you haven't read his books, please do so. They're really, really good. And what else do we want to talk about here? Just mention real quickly that this week there is a special coupon. Hopefully you are following the news on Trigger Point Research. There's going to be a coupon for about 25% off of new subscribers for Trigger Point Research Equity Alerts. You can go and make sure that you're going to get two or three emails. Make sure that you are listed on the update list. You just go to triggerpointresearch.com, and on the bottom, way in the bottom, it says subscribe to newsletters and updates and things like that. Make sure your name's in there, and you'll get that coupon code for that. And there's a really special one coming from Commodity Alerts that is really something that you should look at. And you can get the auto trade and all that, or just subscribe to it. And just make sure you have your name in there, because you'll get these every once in a while. We haven't done a discount for some time, but I thought, hey, it was March, my birthday month. What the heck? So again, thanks for joining me, and I hope you have a profitable week. We'll see you next time. Make sure to put your various comments and, of course, some reviews on iTunes. I really appreciate that very much. Listen to DH Unplugged. That's coming out on Wednesday. We missed last week. We'll be back again this week. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.